Hello, I'm Charles Mallett, and this is a UK column interview. There will be notes and any relevant links posted below this interview at ukcolumn.org. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Sir Julian Rose, who is a front-running pioneer of the organic movement in farming, and he has put his money where his mouth is by having carried out the very practices that he espoused for a long period of time. And in particular, he concentrates on the small-scale production of food for a local market. So, Julian, I'm delighted to have you on today, and thank you very much for joining. I think for the viewers and listeners that perhaps aren't so familiar with your work and your background, what I'd like to do is just set the scene. So, could you just describe your introduction, as it were, to organic practices and where your philosophy came from and how you saw the sort of the economic and practical viability of conducting agricultural practices in that way?
Certainly, I'll try to do that. Well, it came from a very unlikely direction. Actually, I inherited the Hardwick estate when I was 19 years old on the death of my father. And I was interested in the arts. In fact, I was thinking I was going to be involved in acting and directing in theatre and in television. And I was in my early 20s. My mother was able to continue the management of the Hardwick estate. And she wasn't really particularly involved in farming, so she hired experts, as they're called, and they all told her, you have to use chemicals. You really won't be able to make anything work unless you use agrochemicals. I, in the meantime, was following through my interest in my career. It was initially in Australia, where I worked on a very large cattle ranch in Queensland, 30,000 cattle being moved from waterhole to waterhole during the winter and working with the Aboriginal people. It was an extremely interesting experience. It was my first really hard experience of farming. When I came back to England, I became involved in developing my interest in theatre and went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, where I studied stage management. I worked after that in repertory theatre for about 6 months, after which time I travelled around America. And out of that experience, when I returned, I realized that the estate, the future of the estate, was becoming critically important in my mind, and I needed to take over from my mother. And I was searching around for what it would be that would draw me, so to speak, emotionally into feeling good about taking this on, because actually you may know, and your audience may know, that there are many incidences when younger sons take over estates where they feel overwhelmed and they can't manage. I was very fortunate at that point, and I was working in Belgium. The theatre company I was working with set up in Belgium, in Antwerp, and we developed a teaching system using the arts and academic studies to teach children and young adults how to express themselves. And while I was there, a lecturer came to give us a talk from England, from an organization called the Soil Association. It was in 1975, to give a talk about something called organic farming. I didn't really know what it was, but when I heard it was about an environmentally friendly approach, I became very interested, and I went to this lecture. At this lecture, a man called Dr. Devin, who came from a college in South London, he was a biologist, explained something about the laws of the land, and that was actually the title of a BBC documentary, which he showed about organic farming in England. Now, we're talking about 1975, a long time ago. But when I saw this film, and when I heard the words of the board members of the Soil Association, I was utterly convinced that this is what I had to do. It was overwhelming, and I was overjoyed, actually, and I bought books and pamphlets and everything I could to try and catch up on the approach that was necessary to achieve the certification, actually, of organic farm foods. And I said to my mother on my return to Hardwick House after this conference, you know, mother, we're going to do something called organic farming. We won't be using any chemicals. And I always remember her answer, oh, I'm so glad. I hate those chemicals. So while she was going down that road, because she was advised by people who supposedly knew that it was the only road to go down, she was particularly pleased to hear that I was intending embarking on a completely different trip. So that's essentially how it happened, that I got involved. And from that moment on, I started converting the farm. And I actually did it slowly over a period of about 8 years, bit by bit by bit, because I couldn't afford to put the whole thing into organic farming. What I did was I rented out. I started with the home farm area, which was about 30 acres. And I rented out the rest of the land, which is on the farm side of Hardwick Estate, around about 300 acres. The estate's just on 1,000 acres. It's divided between forestry and farmland, 50-50, pretty much. And I rented this out to a neighboring farmer. And I said, on one condition, I charge you a lower rent, but you're not to use any nitrate fertilizer and you're not to use pesticides. And he agreed. And actually, he got very good yields because that land hadn't been plowed and sown for a very long time. So that's how it started.
That's a fascinating insight. And it takes me forward to some of the things that I was going to bring up later on, but now seems a good opportunity. When one speaks about this, even to those who are interested in making that change, which, of course, an awful number of people have not done for all sorts of reasons. First of all, you talk about it as being really an emotional decision, you know, wanting to be doing something that felt right.
Yes.
And clearly you came up with a practical solution to that, which I think seems to be the biggest of all the stumbling blocks, particularly where finances are concerned. Is the model that you crafted one that you've seen used elsewhere? Or, I mean, how is it that you see, is there any one way to make that transition, particularly from a financial point of view?
Very good question. Well, the point is, you have to recognize that in those days, when I started, there was no premium for organic food, and no one knew what it even was. It was right at the start. So I was one of the pioneers, really. So I couldn't, there's no point in having my head in the clouds. I had to be very pragmatic and very realistic. And the way that most people in the last 20 or so years have moved into conversions, in my view, is too extreme. They tend to take the whole farm immediately and put it into conversion process, at least people I know quite closely. I can't speak for the majority. I simply don't know. People may have many different methods of doing this. But I think in many cases, they go straight in. You have to have a period of minimum 2 years if you've been using agrochemicals, and of course they will have been, where you fallow the land and just let any residues go down and disappear from the topsoil layer. In minimum 2 years. Some cases, it's longer than that. And this is all overseen by the Soil Association, which is responsible for certifying organic food. And that was not yet happening when I was first started. There wasn't any certification process happening yet, but it developed fairly quickly after I joined. I became a board member of the Soil Association, incidentally, in 1984. Which is when I was about halfway through the process of converting the farm. So my advice would be to people who want to go in to organic farming from conventional farming is that you do take it slowly. Actually, initially, you should look at the results you get on a small area, because some people are skeptical. Even though they go ahead, they still go ahead thinking, oh, nothing's going to work. Well, you don't want to put your whole farm into a situation where you're skeptical that it's going to work, obviously. Your money is going to go down the drain completely. So you should start with a small amount. if you're not sure. And you watch what happens on that piece of land, maybe an atypical piece of land for your farm. And you observe. And if you see the results being good, well, you can then proceed. But you shouldn't rush into it. It would be a mistake.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that's a very critical part of it. There are two bits from what you've just said that I'd like to explore a bit further. The first is results, because I think a lot of people would like to have clearly defined exactly what you mean by that. Because, of course, in the mechanized agrochemical sort of industrial era, results really have tended to mean yield by volume and not necessarily by nutrient density or by soil health or any of those things. So could you just give a sort of detailed qualification of what you mean by the results that you would see?
Yes, certainly. Well, basically, you have to take into account both these issues. Everyone's interested in volume. You know, that's the era we live in. They don't think about, mostly they don't, especially in the early days of going organic, they don't think too much about nutrition. That comes from nutritionalists. You know, everything's divided into different segments these days of expertise. And the farmer isn't even expected to know much about that level. However, you know, if you're emotionally involved, you want to know about it. You know, you're fascinated. And the point being that it shouldn't be money-led. It should be heart-led and head-led. It should be a combination of heart and head. So obviously you're interested in the yield. But in the first phase of growing organic food, you won't be able to ascertain the yield, because you'll get a result based on the condition of the soil at that particular point in time. And it's going to be pretty poor, probably, if you've been using agrochemicals for the last 20 or 30 years or whatever, and nitrate fertilizers, obviously. It's going to be poor. So you can look at the yield and you say, well, that's a very disappointing yield. And when it comes to the nutritional side, you will simply say to yourself, well, I'm glad that this is a product which won't contain pesticide residues or residues of nitrate, because I've learned in the course of my research that these are very bad for health. And not only for human health, it's very bad for the soil health. Soil health depends upon organic matter being recycled continuously and on earthworms particularly having an active existence, and all the various micronutrients that exist under the soil being stimulated to work. So if you were used to putting nitrate on your fields, they didn't have to work, because you were giving them a luxury intake, which meant that it went straight into their veins, as it were. It's like when people shoot up with drugs. That's how agrochemical farming is. It's a drug problem for plant life. So it's not going to happen for at least 3 or 4 years that the soil is going to be brought back to life sufficiently to produce what you might call a yield which would be near average for organic farming.
And then the next but very much related issue is, you described how back at that period there was no premium on organic produce, because of course nobody understood what it was or what it meant.
Yeah.
Given that that obviously has very much changed over time, how do you think the public perception of entry into organic farming has changed? And I talk specifically with regard to the premium. Is it seen as something that might now be more of a business opportunity than an emotional connection with the land?
Well, that largely depends on the size of the farm. You know, there are a number of large organic farmers who proceed with their organic farming in very much the same spirit as they did when they were operating monoculture. That hasn't changed. That doesn't change. But they see that it works, and they see that it does produce an income which makes their farm viable in some form. So for the very large farmer, that's still the main consideration, the economics. But the majority of organic producers are on what you might call middle-sized family farm holdings, mixed organic farms. And then there's an increasingly large number of what we call growers. We tend to separate this in the organic movement. Growers, people growing vegetables and market garden scale and small-scale field like, for instance, up to 10 acres, 15 acres. This is a much more close-up view of how organic farming works. You know, people working the ground themselves with hose and all the rest of it. They're not on big tractors where the ground is a distant view from the cab. The people who really work the land tend to be the market gardeners and the small-scale farmers who are still doing rotational farming, which they have to do if you're going to be organic. You need the animal manure returned to the land. You need your rotational, your crop rotations. In fact, you particularly need them on certified organic farming because you have to have a fertility building period. If you're going to grow, let's say you're going to grow wheat, barley, and oats. Say you grow them. Say you grow wheat, barley, and oats in succession in 1 year. Then you'd have to put your fields down to be very typically grass clover lay to build fertility. And that would be for on my land, which is not the best land. It's pretty poor quality. I always used to do 3 year. On high quality soil, you could get away with 2 years. And ideally, you would then graze that grass clover lay with sheep or cattle, possibly even put hens on if you have free range hens. And that way you add obviously further nutrients and you create a better mix for the soil. So when it comes to the financial results of this and the question of the premium, what you find, and I'm bringing this very up to date now, is that a lot of the smaller people have given up on certification. It's expensive. It's very time consuming. The rule book for organic farming is now a sort of Bible. It's very thick. And there are very, very precise rules and regulations. And you have to conform to them if you want to maintain your certification. And in order to sell organic food into the marketplace, you have to have a certified food if you're going to call it organic. I think there's been one or two trial court cases where people have sold organic without being certified, and the judge has come down in favor of that being illegal. So people have got the message. So I'm rather ambivalent about this because I was involved and I, for many, many years, on the Soil Association board, and I was even involved in setting standards, creating standards in the very beginning. So I recognize the necessity for them, but I sympathize with the very small farmer who finds it all too much and simply wants to get on with the job. Now, I think what you'll find is that in the modern movement, as it were, quite a few people with 10, 15, 20 acres are not certifying, but are going on reputation. They're contacting their local public, they're selling direct, or through farm shop, or through a box scheme, which is more popular and is quite, or farmers market. And in those situations, they won't be able to say this is organic, but they'll be able to say it's grown without any pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, or nitrate fertilizers. And you could call it organic. You know, you can say that. And the public will sympathize. And actually, I think that they welcome usually the public onto their farms, these sort of people. And sometimes even pick your own, you know, public get involved in picking the strawberries at the end of the season, whatever. So you integrate your local public into your farming. And I think that's the future. I think certification will be just the big boys. The big boys, if there is substantial progress made at a governmental level encouraging large-scale farmers to convert to organic, okay, that'll mean certification remains very much at the center of everything. But it will be a divided world, I'm afraid. There'll be the small and the medium-sized getting involved locally, and there'll be the big boys going directly into the marketplace.
You used to advise the British government. Now, to what degree do you think it's likely that there would be a push by the government towards organic practices or practices that you would recognise as being genuinely organic?
Interesting question. Well, you know about Green New Deal, I presume.
Yeah.
So it's actually under the auspices of the World Economic Forum. at the moment, and government can actually just pass the buck in that direction. Or you could say Agenda 2030 Sustainable Development Plan for the UK. And in that is an identikit with the WEF's Green New Deal. So there's no difference between the two. However, when you start examining the smaller print about what the Green New Deal is, you discover that it isn't green, and nor is it a deal. It's a very dark non-deal, and it involves going down a route which has very little to do with what we're talking about. In fact, it involves pretty much getting farmers off the land and replacing them with robots. I mean, and it's actually in the Fourth Industrial Revolution, if anyone wants to buy Klaus Schwab's book. He wrote a book called Green New Deal, but he also wrote another one about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And all the details are in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. That's because it's a move to, it's a move towards AI, artificial intelligence, and robotics. And they propose that food should be grown in laboratories, petri dishes in the case of meat, fake genetically modified meat. And in the case of dairy products, there are already two large laboratory factories in England producing synthetic genetically modified milk. And that's what Schwab recommends. Quite obviously, the reasoning behind it from the standpoint of the Green New Deal is it's the only way to achieve net zero by 2050. Yes, I wrote an article about net zero saying, what does net zero actually mean? You know, neither of those words mean anything. It sounds like something to do with accounting. Net instead of brutto. Zero, net zero, zero. So zero accounting, is that what it means? It's all gobbledygook. It's all complete nonsense. So the thing is that under the Green New Deal and under the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the plan is to get farmers off the land and say cows and livestock in general, because they give off methane, have to be excluded because methane's a contributor to global warming, according to the government or according to the International Panel for Climate Change. And all these pseudoscientists, frankly, are pushing in that direction. And that ultimately lands up, although we won't be discussing that today, in a transhuman scenario where even human beings become connected up to computers and our brains are basically used to pile information in at a very high and intense level, and we become semi-robotic as a human race. This is the Fourth Industrial Revolution. It's very extreme. Most people find it difficult to believe. But by now, I hope many more people do believe it because it's being pushed harder and harder. So really, it's a long way of answering the question, what will government say about organic farming? Well, government will say, yes, we've included this. We are proposing actually to create 25% of UK as organic farms. It's part of the Green New Deal. And there are, unfortunately, a few people out there who believe them and who think, oh, good, we finally got the government interested. But they don't realize that just under the surface of the thing is this nightmare dystopian scenario, which looks much worse than anything George Orwell conceived of in 1984.
That's very well put. And as you say, on the AI transhumanist agenda, we'll perhaps return to that another time. There's a lot of ground to cover today. But I think one thing that you do bring out, which is very pertinent, is the what could be perceived as the hijacking of what starts out as an initially positive campaign for the right reasons. And I would cite, say, a sort of legitimate environmental movement having been captured by the notion that there's a climate emergency and so forth. Going back to the Soil Association, is there any suggestion that that the Soil Association and sort of affiliated bodies have in the same way been captured? I mean, with reference to what you're saying about the government suggesting that they want to put 25% of farmland into organic. And then I think, I'm reminded of Therese coffee whilst the minister was suggesting that even glyphosate had a part to play in regenerative farming. So really, I mean, I just wonder what you have to say about the danger of these initially positive movements being subverted or hijacked.
It's already been subverted and hijacked, there's no doubt. I already resigned in 2000 from my role in the Soil Association board because I saw it being hijacked even then. Yes, people were getting interested in supermarket as the main sales point for organic food, and my view was no. And the founders of the Soil Association back in 1946 were very remarkably erudite and thoughtful people. The founder was a woman called Lady Eve Balfour, who was a soil scientist. But she had a very remarkable board at that time, made up of homeopathic doctors, nutritionalists, soil scientists, farmers experimenting with many different sorts of livestock combinations, very progressive people. And what came out of this was the position, real food, organic food, should be sold fresh and local. End of story.
Yeah.
End of story. Now, I actually believe in that. And I think if the Soil Association had stuck to that principle, we'd be far further down the line of local food for local people at the highest quality end, of course. Whereas I'm afraid my colleagues of Soil Association were captivated by the concept of supermarkets actually saying, we'd be interested in taking some of your organic food. And it was like, wow, you know, Tesco's wants to take organic. And it was, they couldn't resist. They said, we must do it. And then a theory was developed. You can't grow the organic movement unless you sell in supermarkets. And it just became a sort of buzz phrase. You can't grow the organic movement unless you sell in supermarkets. And it was gone. It was gone. I'm afraid now, well, yes, it's similar to what I was saying about certification, actually. The smaller scale people tend to look at it more holistically because they recognize that selling direct is the only way to make enough income. You couldn't anyway go through a third party and into a situation like a supermarket sale where anyway they reject usually 50% of what you offer them in terms of fruit and vegetables because it doesn't look right. That's all they really care about, what it looks like. And the nutritional value of stuff in supermarkets is rubbish, of course. It's traveled halfway around the world and was about a week old. And, you know, all the rest have been through about 6 temperature changes. And by the time people buy stuff in supermarkets, all the vitamins and nutrients and energy is gone. But it looks nice. Yes, it does look nice. So organic farming has fallen into this trap. And I'm afraid it's just a learning process. It's a very steep learning process for people. They realize later that they got it wrong. But we aren't quite there yet.
This is it. And I think for the vast majority, I mean, obviously, I would be, you know, very interested to hear your view of essentially the sort of the psychological and practical and financial trap that farmers have found themselves in. And of course, you've just spoken about you know, Lady Balfour back in 1946, just before the 1947 Agriculture Act, and then again, your transition in the 70s at the same time as the nature of subsidy was changing with the European Economic Community and all of that sort of thing. So, of course, the argument now, the counter argument to what you're saying is, well, effectively, it's too difficult. You know, how on earth are people going to find a market, supermarkets? Although the relationship isn't good and the groceries code adjudicator is useless and all that sort of stuff, how do we actually get out of it? What's the incentive for farmers to change what they're doing?
Well, I mean, we are talking about larger, medium-sized and large farms, as I keep pointing out, because on the smaller scale, supermarkets won't even take food from small farmers. They're not interested. They want a very large volume supplied by one or two farms. So you're in that league. And the incentive would probably be that there was either a scandal on a level which was almost national, if not global, about the results of having food which has been covered with pesticides and nitrate fertilizers and all the rest of it, and some health factor emerged which was critically important. That's one, but it doesn't look likely at the moment, although you never know what's around the corner these days. The second would be that the supermarkets let the farmers down over and over and over again in terms of what they will pay. That's much more likely, the scenario. And the farmer is squeezed, just like conventional farmers are today. You know, that's why there's so many farmers are upset, because they're paid, you know, a tiny percentage of what the end price is for that product. You know, for a loaf of bread, I think it's only about 4 pence out of the total. So the financial issue again comes around and looms strongly in the foreground for why someone would say, we can't go on this way. But the options might not be available to them yet to be able to sell locally. Because my farm is near Reading. It's only 5 miles from Reading in South Oxfordshire. And I'm surrounded by consumers. quite affluent consumers, quite obviously, in that part of the world. But you might be stuck somewhere else in England, and highly likely you would be, where you're not surrounded by towns and villages and rather affluent consumers. So what do you do then? No, this is a major question. The possible solution would be the development of cooperatives. And they do exist, and they are increasing, and they are potentially a very good solution, where a number of farms would sell into a cooperative set up in their regional, and the farm would be and the produce would be distributed from the cooperative, and people would be able to go to the cooperative also to buy in bulk. That's about the only light on the horizon, I think, for large farmers at this point in time. Of course, the third option is to keep going as one is and beg for higher subsidies. Now, the thing is, the way organic farming is now subsidized is very complex. There are about 7 different tranches of payment, and they are based on conditions of environmental and insect-friendly and bird-friendly and hedgerow-friendly and all the rest of the conditions. So, you know, you will have different payments based on how far you've got on these various diversification on the environmental side. And the subsidy is pretty significant. My guess is that most organic farmers on that scale are at least 50% subsidized already. And the thing is, when you're gone down that road, you're a slave, of course, unfortunately. You simply have no way out other than a major breakout. And that would be only possible if you viewed your farm in the following spirit. It's too big. There's very few people running it. I can hardly afford to pay the wages. I'll break my farm down into 10 different units for people who want to grow on a smaller scale and who are enthusiastic about environmental issues and quality food, all the rest of it. And I'll let people start on that land at a low rent, possibly a very low rent. But you wouldn't have any expenses as a landlord, or very few. You might be responsible for putting up fences originally, possibly putting in a water supply if it didn't exist. But not much else. You might be kind enough to put a shed up for the incoming person, but you wouldn't be obliged to do that depending on the incomer's financial position. This way, a landowner would be free of the expenses of capitalization of a modern farm. It's absolutely huge. There's nothing under 2 million quid to get started these days. If you're on a large scale, say you wanted a herd of 60 or 70 cows and whatever it might be. So I think that would be the most intelligent route to go down. But I haven't got any evidence of anybody doing it yet. But I'm throwing it out there on this program in case there's a farmer who's interested. I think it's a very interesting prospect. And what's more, it kills two birds with one stone, because it helps young aspiring farmers who haven't got really any money to get on the land, to get on the farming ladder, as it's called. And, you know, that person might become very integrated onto one's estate or onto one's big farm eventually. You might find it extremely useful. And the thing would work both ways. And you would start to get a revival of the rural economy based on this approach, breaking vast monocultural farms down to small-scale, environmentally friendly, high food quality, small farms run by keen entrepreneurial people.
I think the audience would share your hope that there might be people listening that would exactly, you know, sort of chime with what you've said. The unfortunate reality is, again, exactly like you said, that subsidy does create slaves, and the slaves therefore must do what the holder of the purse strings dictates. And so, of course, we find this, you know, we're in the situation where there are certainly protests about all sorts of things across Europe, and more recently to a limited extent in Wales. But at the moment, the nature of the protest seems to be about the specifics of the system that they're already trapped within. We're told that the United Kingdom has, you know, produces approximately 60% of its own food. I'm not sure of the veracity of that statistic, but bearing in mind all these land management schemes, and as you say, the sort of the influence of the Green New Deal, if more and more land is to be taken out of production, and there are still very few people who are understanding things in the way that you are, realistically, where do you see things going?
Well, look, you know, this is the Green New Deal, Fourth Industrial Revolution. This is the plan between you and me and your audience. It is the plan. That is the hidden agenda, is to take land out of production. Now, I think, personally, this is a personal view, and I've done quite a lot of research into this, that organic farming will not be considered a problem. Organic farmers will be supported and kept. And in fact, the elite who want to maintain their positions of power on the planet all want and already eat organic food. I don't know whether this is still the case, but 20-odd years ago, there was only organic food being served in the House of Commons restaurant. You see what I'm getting at? You see, the point is that they would like most farms taken out of production. They would like to rewild, and then put some more trees. They would like to put photovoltaic panels on an industrial scale, on wind turbines on an industrial scale, and concreting more urban development, new housing. And they would like to make it possible for consumers to have access to very beautiful bits of countryside, which will be undoubtedly maintained under the AONB, Area Outstanding Natural Beauty, and all the other regimes like that. And farming and farmers, in the sense that we're discussing them and exist still now, would be out. So that makes you ask us, well, what do people eat? Because that's come back to, I'm afraid, this unfortunate scenario, where under, for instance, Bill Gates's view of the future, we'll be eating insects. In fact, here in Poland, where I'm sitting at the moment, because I'm the president of the International Coalition to Protect Polish Countryside. I'm very involved in protecting the Polish small farmer as my main work. And what happens under that situation is that the small farmer is really forced out by various forms of legislation that say that is not possible under global warming measures, what you're doing. Already in Oregon, in America, they are closing down gardeners, even, and small farmers who have chickens and cows, and saying, and they're using the excuse that they're taking too much water from under the ground. Now, this is small farmers, this is not vast farmers using huge irrigation, you know. And they're saying, oh, no, the water's needed for local trout farm, which is much more important. And this is going to make money for the state, and therefore small farmers have to be out. So anything like that means the demise of the small farmer and the middle-sized, what I call SME, small and medium-sized, traditional mixed family farm, under enormous pressure at this moment in time already, many bankrupt. Every 2 weeks, a farmer in that category commits suicide in England. Yes. They are on their knees. The situation is dire, absolutely dire, but it's being forced on and on and on down this route where everything is conciliated towards saving the planet from global warming. Everything is under that ticket. I personally think a revolution is needed, but I see them, people these days, with their mobile phones and their IT fascination. They don't seem to be able to use their brain cells more than, actually, I think we only use less than 1% of our brain cells, even those of us who can actually think. I dread to think of the people on spend half their time on their mobile phones. I dread to think what they do. But, you know, they've got us covered for revolution point of view. They've got us covered because we're being completely brainwashed by the media and by the tall talk, the politicians and all this. And people seem to have less and less ability to resist. One of the things that helps one resist, incidentally, is getting one's hand in the soil and working the land and being with animals and things. When you come back and you sit behind a computer, you feel refreshed and human again. So food's not only thing on the agenda, there's remaining human and earthed in the days of digitalization, algorithms and IT. That's almost as important as food.
I think you've hit upon such an important point. We've seen over the last few years how terrifically pliable the public are in the face of repetitive messaging from the media. You've just cited the climate emergency. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's now going to be zoonotic disease from animals or methane from cows. The chances are the vast majority of the public are going to swallow it. So the question sort of could be, well, how do we change the messaging? How do we get it sort of into the public consciousness that these are the dangers? But let's face it, the reality of achieving that is diminishing, ever diminishing, as people spend more time on their mobile telephones and are further divorced from reality, etc. So I think, for the audience who are, of course, listening and watching this because they're interested in knowing what they can do, if we accept perhaps that it is unrealistic to imagine that farmers are going to make those enormous transitions, what do you think about the actions that people can take at the individual, family, and sort of small group, small community level in terms of whether it is acquiring land or just simply getting on with the sorts of processes that could benefit both the environment and their own food security?
Yes, this is the question that most people have on their minds. They don't have them sufficiently strongly on their minds, however, to work out the solution. I shouldn't have to say. Really, people can't be that stupid. I mean, if you can't work out what you need to do in a situation which is moving in the direction, as long as you believe what I'm telling people about Green New Deal and the fourth industrial, and if you don't, read Klaus Schwab's book or simply get on the internet and do some research on alternative channels to Google and Chrome, whatever it's called. I mean, you have to go into the area where you can research the alternative view on what's happening on our planet. Otherwise, you're nowhere, because all the rest of the stuff is completely controlled now. You know, surveillance is everywhere. You cannot put something out there which is telling the truth without it being immediately, this needs to be fact-checked, this is not true. You know, the truth. Truth is very dangerous these days, and that's what George Orwell said in 1984. So within the context of what I'm saying, it's obvious, actually. You should do two things quite immediately, I would say. First of all, your diet is critical. So you must get off the standard form of diet, which is considered safe when it's not, because the health issue is long-term. You won't see results in 10, 15 years. You'll see them in 20, 30 years. With the sort of problems we have with low nutritional food and pesticide residues and nitrate and all the rest of the things and genetically modified bits getting into it, plastics now getting in, all of it. So you have to try and think about the future of yourself and your family in terms of a diet which is healthy and which is full of life and vitamins. That means you have to bypass supermarkets. Now, this is a big problem for people because, first of all, they're totally addicted to the convenience factor of the supermarket, totally addicted. And the fact that you can, you know, order stuff and it'll be delivered to your home, you don't have to move a finger there. So to suggest you have to go straight from that convenience scenario to one where you have to go searching around for some farmer who you might be able to persuade to grow some real food for you, or farm shops in your area that are growing organic food or food at least with the minimum use of pesticides, because it doesn't have to be only organic. It's a mistake to go down the route of being too purist. You know, it's all right if you meet a good farmer and you get a good vibration from him, you know this person cares about the way they treat their land and their animals. So you don't really have to demand organic. You simply have to know that they're taking a caring approach and will only use the minimum of pesticides. If you can do that and you can find someone, you might be able to set up a situation where you can track that farmer to grow so many tons of food for you a year, or I mean, tons or kilograms or whatever. And if you got together with a lot of other local people with the same concept in their mind, you might be able to set up a roundtable discussion between local farmers and local consumers and say to the farmers, we would be interested in buying direct from you, no middleman. We'll pay a fair price if you give us fair, high quality, fresh local food. And any farmer who's worth his salt and who is in financial trouble must think twice about that proposal. Must, because it's a lifeline. It's their only lifeline, probably. So they would directly deal with the general public, and the general public would directly deal with them. But this is people who have to use the gumption, get out there, research, find out what's available, where, and how to stimulate some sort of possibility for the future. The other issue which comes up immediately, of course, is the one of how much time and energy and perhaps even money one's prepared to put into the issue of food, because it's slipped over the last 50 years from being third to being about seventh in importance now. It's I don't know, I may be wrong about this, someone may correct me, but it's certainly slipped. I don't know where to. So it's not on top of the list even. It's like, oh God, we can buy an instant something, something in the freezer thing, and then stuck it in the microwave, and yeah, good, thanks, you know. Now I can go back to my Netflix. And then that's the modern day. But people who are feeling nervous, irritable, somewhat fearful about the future should question the psychology of their condition. Why are you feeling that? What are you feeling that about? Ask yourself these questions. Is it because you feel you have almost no control over your destiny? Is it because you no longer trust the politicians who claim to be representing you in Parliament? Is it both those things, plus the fact that there's a very uneasy feeling on the world with wars going on and horrors like Gaza and Ukraine, etc., and all these things combined make you feel completely unable to feel that you have control over your destiny? Well, if you do feel that, the first place to start from is food. Rebuild from food. Get out of the city if you possibly can. I'm talking to people who still have the option to move. Try to find somewhere in the countryside where you feel more relaxed and more better air quality and even the possibility that you might have a small piece of land and start trying to grow your own food. I'm talking about mostly people probably under 60, because, you know, it's unlikely if you're 60 and above that you'll be getting out there with your hoe and your shovel and digging like crazy, try and grow enough food. But the allotments in England are overwhelmingly popular. And that's the closest thing we have in the UK to a way of supporting yourself by growing your own food. It's a very traditional, long-standing thing in England to have an allotment. They're all, in most places, they're all taken up. You know, you can't find one. But in some cases, unfortunately, counties have sold them off. So no, you don't have that opportunity anymore. And that would be the typical direction things will go in today. So people really must use their brain power and do some research and make a sort of pact with yourself to get onto a new foot forward and get involved with your food and your food production. And as I said before, via cooperatives, yes, farm shops, yes, box schemes, yes, farmers markets, yes. You know, that's the starting point. Wean yourself off the supermarket and the whole convenience thing. Throw out your mobile phone and start a new life.
I think that the words to make a pact with yourself will really resonate with the audience. And I think that's fantastic guidance. I would also like to say, I'm sure there are many over 60-year-olds who would happily get out there with their shovel and go for it. What I would like to do is just take you back a little bit. You spoke about the consumption of organic food for the elite and whatnot, which puts me in mind of the now King Charles III, with whom you have worked over the years. I think anybody who's watched and listened so far or has been aware of your career to date will believe that your philosophy and your practices have been consistent right the way through. So given his influence, and in particular I refer to the Terra Carta and the suggestion that 30% of the landmass of the UK will be in nature recovery by 2030 and 50% by 2050 and all that sort of thing. How do you perceive his part in all of this?
Ooh, I know this sort of thing can travel when I start talking about King Charles. Well, he's split. He is in his heart a believer and an example of someone who's converted his own home farm at Highgrove to organic back in 1986. And he's an enthusiast. He's also an enthusiast for mixed family farms generally. He's a traditionalist, after all. So he's conservative, he's a traditionalist, and he recognizes quality when he sees it, quite obviously. But on the other hand, his role as the monarch, and even when he was prince, and his background and his education within royal family, etc., means that he's also trapped by the status quo of the system, which maintains royalty as a voice of the empire. I use the word empire symbolically because we don't have an empire as such anymore, but many of us, including me, were brought up to believe that that was our role in life, to be, so to speak, leaders of the empire and to be able to take decisions without having to draw on one's emotions. So the King of England is split by these two things. He would like to, I think, support the future of farming in a mixed organic, not necessarily even organic, traditional rotational farming of high quality food sold direct to the public. But as monarch in a very powerful hierarchy at the top of that pyramid, he sits next to Klaus Schwab at Davos and the World Economic Forum, and he agrees to the introduction of Green New Deal and the Fourth Industrial Revolution. In fact, He was one of the first people to announce it. And you knew he was reading a script when he did it. It was obviously put in front of him, and he was told to say this. And he did say it. And he does say it. And he even gave he created an award for the best design of some innovative products. He's good at this. He likes to do this sort of thing. And what did he come up with? A young man who invented a COVID-style mask to put over the nose of cows to prevent methane coming out of them when they chew the cud. And he was so thrilled by this, Prince Charles. He was there. No, he wasn't. It was already when he was king. You know, this is the extraordinary hypocrisy of modern-day leaders, actually. And let's say he's by no means unique. In fact, he's one of many who are through and through caught in a sort of trap which they don't seem to know how to deal with. And it does involve, ultimately, outright hypocrisy. And what can one say about that?
There is a terrific degree of hypocrisy out there, which perhaps an increasing number of people are becoming aware of or alive to. Now, we've covered a very broad range of topics, I think, through the course of this discussion. What I'd like to do is sort of begin to conclude, but in order to do so, because I think, you know, you have articulated the issues as you see them, but provided a way in which people can realistically get out of it. Now, I think I'm right in saying the most recent article you've published on your website is entitled "Whom the Gods Would Destroy, They First Make Mad," in 24th yes. February. Now, towards the end of it, you write, "Have no doubt that an extraordinary reversal of fortunes lies ahead, a gathering storm that will sweep aside all that which so desperately attempts to thwart the rising tide of human emancipation." I find those words very powerful, very inspiring. Just to close out, will you just elaborate on what exactly you mean by that?
Well, thank you very much for quoting that. I mean, I'm delighted because this is very close to my heart. What I really say in here is, in the course of history and in the course of the evolution of the species and in the course of a higher form of existence which we are all coming from, we have a source point of a divine being who we are all beneficiaries of, like sparks, if you like, of a god. So within us we have an extraordinary capacity to bring change in a very positive sense, and in a very deep sense, spiritual sense. And spirituality is critically important. It's not a popular subject because it brings up too much of what's going the opposite way. But when you do start talking about spirituality, you start recognizing that it's actually extremely simple. You know, that there's a feeling of joy, of beauty, respect for people, love, creativity. All these things are one expression of some direction which we all in common would like our planet to be moving in, and our society and our locality. There's nobody, I don't think, who would deny that, apart from psychopaths and similar people who are sick. And there's plenty of them, unfortunately. So what I believe is that people who are in positions of power, falsely so, because they don't possess wisdom. So you really shouldn't be a leader if you don't have wisdom. I'm going to keep it very, very simple. These people start becoming like the emperor who wore no clothes. They are exposing themselves to people, ordinary people, who still can work with common sense, who still have feelings, who still have empathy towards other people, who are compassionate, who are just good heart-led, simple, straightforward people. They are revealing themselves to those people as crazy, completely irresponsible. So this is part of what in Eastern philosophy is called karma. The people who are doing all the damage will eventually have a terrific karmic burden and will have to be exposed to, I don't know how long, in a situation where they suffer the consequences of what they perpetrated on other people. It's a law of physics. It's not purely a spiritual law, although it's well known, in particularly in the eastern sector of the planet. It's a law of physics, this action and reaction. Those who do harm to people will suffer harm. And what is, I think, going to happen, and it's happening increasingly fast, is that people aren't making sense who are in positions of power. And for a while, ordinary people say, I can't understand them. You say, put the burden on themselves. I don't understand what he was saying. But actually, you should reverse it and say, he doesn't seem to know what he's talking about. Ah, now then, now we're progressing. You know, we're not just slaves sitting back and, oh dear, we're so stupid, we, Irenic, we can understand these. On the contrary, we know far more. We can see what's going on. And if we use that side of ourselves and give ourselves back the power that we actually have and we were provided with by a divine source in all our lives, their clothes will fall off those emperors much faster, and we will be able to point it out to them. I'm sorry, mate. You're naked. We can see through you. It's rubbish that you're talking. We've had enough of you. Out.
Very well put. Now, Julian, before I let you go, please tell the audience where they can find out more about what you are doing, what you have done, and anywhere that you can point them towards to follow up.
I don't have any social media. I don't own a mobile phone. I have no television set. I do have a website, which is www.julianrose.info, www.julianrose.info. And there you will find my writings and more about my past. I think there's a bio on there about my earlier work and various other bits and pieces. So I think that's the best place to look. Don't go to WikiLeaks because WikiLeaks, not funny, I use it. Don't go to Wikipedia because I had all my stuff removed because I didn't like it. And they told me I'd have to redo it in a much more professional way. So I simply ignore it. It simply tells you that I'm a baronet of Montreal and of Hardwick. That's all they tell you. So you know that now, so you don't need to look.
Good. Well, thank you for that. And as I said earlier, links and notes to the interview will be published at ukcolumn.org. So please make sure to share this interview very widely. I should also say that if you're not doing so already, but you are in a position to support the UK Column financially in order that we continue to bring interviews such as this to you, then please go to ukcolumn.org and either donate or join as a member. So it just remains for me to say to Julian, thank you very much indeed for what has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. And I hope we'll talk again at some point in the future. But we wish you well. And it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles. And congratulations on your initiation into UK Column, which I've been following for many years and find it exemplary news broadcasting. And long may you last.
Good. Thank you very much. That's lovely.